Mobile Park Donna, Texas. Birthplace is Decatur, Illinois. And his birthday is February 5th, 1887. Theodore Carr is best known for his 45 years in law enforcement. And his service in the United States Marines in China. His activity as a customs service officer and as a border patrolman.
Theodore Carr. I was born in Decatur, Illinois,
February 5th, 1887.
When I was 3 years old, my father was appointed Consul General in Sydney, Australia. And we lived in Sydney 2.5 years. Then we came back to Iowa. We lived in near Webster City, Iowa then until I was 12 years old. Then my father raised racehorses. And I rode them. I trained them from the time I was 8 years old. I spent most of my summers training racing colts. And when I was 12 years old, a drought dried up all the crops in Iowa. And my father decided to move back to Indiana, which he did. He had a big sale, sold all his land, stopped. Except two racing colts. He left them, and I there, in the care of a man who had never even seen me before, but who did know how hard it would be for a kid to purchase their feet and necessities for those two colts and himself. So he helped me. He worked for us. I made all the races that summer at the county fairs that had racetracks all up through the central part of Iowa and up into South Dakota. And did very good. Then in the fall, when the races ended, when the no more county fairs all ended, then I went back to that place where I'd been staying, and he furnished me quarters and places to keep my ponies, my horses, that winter, and I went to school there. And the teacher of that school was amazed at my knowledge and how I was able to hold up my end of it in the classes without ever having been in school before. But anyway, we got along very nicely, and the next spring, when I was 13, went out for another year or summer of racing, and went up as far as eastern South Dakota, southern Minnesota, and all over the state of Iowa, and made lots of money. I really did clean up that summer in those races. And then that fall, I sold my two colts to the chief of the Minnesota Sioux Indian tribe at Pipestone, Minnesota. And it gave me some total in the banks of some $35,000, which wouldn't be much nowadays, but at those days it was quite an honorable amount for a 14-year-old kid to start out in life with. And I went to a school in northern Indiana. It was a kind of a, it was boys there. It was a boys' school. And they lived there. What do you call this down here to Hobbinson? There's a school down there of the for boys only.
Academy is a.
Huh? It was an academy for homeless children, and they didn't know until I'd gone there about 3 months that I wasn't homeless. I was just a wanderer. And after about 6 months there, they decided that I didn't belong there and that I should go and go to a real school, high school. And I learned so fast and was able to assimilate the workings of a school so fast that the teachers were amazed. And I had no regular, I had nothing to show them, no papers. They wouldn't give me any papers of any kind showing where I'd gone to school. But I finally went down to my uncle had a cotton plantation in Tennessee. And I went down there and he helped me get into a school there that was a branch of a religious organization. I don't remember what the name was. I know too, but I can't name it now. But anyway, I went to school there for a year, and then they also had a medical school in Nashville, that same organization. And I passed the entrance papers sufficiently good that I entered that medical school, and I went there for 3 years, lacking 5 months. I had a little trouble there. And so I left there and went to can you help me with a little bit of I went to Norfolk, Virginia and joined the Marine Corps. I enlisted in the Marine Corps in Norfolk, Virginia, and Norfolk March the 6th, 1908. March the 6th, 1908. I joined the Marine Corps. And they were going to send a detachment of Marines to China with the American ambassador, the American embassy ambassador, American ambassador's guard in oh heaven, I should have gone over this before you came.
Peking,
China. And I went there as the medical officer with that Marine detachment. And I was only there just a few weeks when those mounted banditos swore they were going to eliminate all the white people in Peking. And there was anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000 of them attacked it there on horses. But the high wall protected us, protected all the foreigners there. And they didn't succeed in killing them all. They killed quite a few. But the banditos were piled outside of those high walls there in walls, in piles 10 feet high. But I got shot in that leg. That's where I got shot. And then they sent me back to the States, to Norfolk, Virginia. And went to hospital in Norfolk, Marine Hospital. And I was there for a year. And the leg didn't get any better, and it got worse. And I got what they call phlebitis in that leg. Multiple thrombophlebitis. And after a year in that naval hospital in Norfolk, Virginia, they put me on a boat, battleship, a Navy boat of some kind, and sent me to Brooklyn Navy Yard, Brooklyn, New York. And I went to Brooklyn Naval Hospital. I was there a total of about 6 or 8 months. I don't remember exactly. They put me, they wanted to know if I would like to take a trip to see. Maybe the air, change of air, would benefit me. Now I gotta find that. My Navy discharge, my Marine discharge. So they sent me, put me aboard a ship, and we made a 3 months trip, about 3 months, or 2.5 months, I guess, was it? 2.5 months to sea on this battleship Rhode Island, the old battleship Rhode Island. It's no more now, of course, it's been destroyed. Years ago, but this was in 1909. Well, it didn't seem to improve me any aboard the ship there, so I turned around and came back to Brooklyn Navy Yard, and I went up to Brooklyn Naval Hospital, and I was up there a few days, and they gave me another examination, and they asked me what I wanted to do. Did I want to stay around there, go to another hospital, or discharge? And I said, well, I'll take the discharge, because I want to go home and see my people anyhow. I never have lived at home and be changed. So they give me my discharge.
Okay, back on now.
I listened the 6th day of March, 1908, at Indianapolis, Indiana. I was hereby honorably discharged upon report of the medical survey, disease for injury in the line of duty. Well, you can read it. My gosh.
Okay. Injury in the line of duty, Theodore Carr, February 5th, 18.
I was born February 5th.
Born, okay. Decatur, what year? Third day of September, 1909.
Yeah.
Okay, one year. Okay.
All right. But here's some events that took place before that. On May the 7th, I went aboard the USS Rhode Island for that trip, and that trip lasted till June the 29th. May 7th to June 29th, 1909. They don't say that it was just for my health, but they didn't dare to. Then on August the 27th, 1909, this was signed by the Chief of Staff, Acting Adjutant Colonel, something, I don't know, Single. Service honest and faithful. And here's the amount of money that they paid me when I left there, and so forth and so on. Signed by W.M. Biddle, William Biddle, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, Commanding Marines. That's quite a document.
Yes. Hmm? Indeed. Okay, what, when you were discharged from the Marines, what happened then? I mean, like,
it don't say down here, does it?
No.
Objection to reenlistment, yes. Recommendations?
Well, what I mean is...
Service, honest and faithful.
Mm-hmm. What did you do after you left the Marines?
I thought it was on there. Oh. I was sitting in a wheelchair, and they gave me the wheelchair and a pair of crutches and said I'd never be able to use the crutches until I could get my foot bound up to where it would stay put. You see, that leg was shot off. There was no way to hold it steady. There was no bone down through the center of it at all. And so I had to go to Germany. Well, I came home to visit my people. I brought my crutches and my wheelchair home. They lived in Indiana at that time, at Kewanee, Indiana. And I stayed there a few months, and finally I convinced my dad that I knew what I was talking about, and we sailed, bought tickets from there to the west, to the east coast, and got tickets and went to Germany. And I used to remember the details of all that, but I can't name it right now, today. But anyway, in Germany, the doctors there operated on that leg and inserted pieces of bone from other animals. I have a piece of a chicken wing, a rabbit's, a piece out of the nose of a rabbit, a piece of bone from a sheep leg too, from the leg of a sheep, a little young lamb. Darn, I think the other one, there's four of them, but there's four different animals representing that leg. And they growed, they stuck, every one of them stuck that he transplanted into that leg, they stuck and they growed. You see, there was a space there of 2.5 inches that had no bone at all.
Wow.
And the bone itself would not, it'll not grow unless it's growing onto something. So he had to put that little piece of bone in there and get him to touch him, to get through there.
Of course, they had their own boats, you know, and crews well trained on that.
Now then, several years down there, and I just wanted you to see what all we see really there. I talked one day for about a half a day to some people about Central America and one thing, another, and when it was all over, he said, that guy's been down there all right, you know, but I think he's grown a whole lot. All right. That's a fact. I didn't, of course, they never saw any of this stuff, you know. That's why I'm just showing you this stuff here, because...
Oh, yes, you were there.
How was that?
I said, yes, you were there.
Oh, yeah, I don't want to lose that. That thing there is worth its weight in gold, you know. This here should be recorded. I'll read it to you. Well, I'll be darned. And here I have a State Department passport from the Department of State in the United States. Theodore O'Carr, I had to use O in my name to distinguish me from another Theodore Carr. From a guy named Carr that adopted the name of Theodore. They called him Bob and he didn't like it and he changed it to Theodore and found out there were two of us Theodore, so I put an O in mine to keep our correspondence separate. That's the way I looked about 70 years ago. Or did you get it?
Yeah, I looked over it. I'm gonna, you know.
Oh.
You know, and go into a little bit of detail with them.
Well, I have here in my hand a passport from the Department of State of the United States of America, showing that Theodore O'Carr was to return to Guatemala and Honduras, Central America, for him. Employment, the United Fruit Company. On the 6th day of December, 1919. Showing a photo, and I was 32 years old at the time. Born in Decatur, Illinois, on February the 5th, 1887.
Okay. Which countries does this include?
Oh, this is a passport to Vice Consul, British Honduras. This is British Honduras.
Okay.
And this one is for Costa Rica, and this one is for Consulado General de
Honduras.
Oh, this is for British Honduras, and this is for, oh, this is for leaving British Honduras.
You have to get a passport to get in and one to get out. I went up to Minnesota and visited my blood brother up there. I have a blood brother who is the leader of the Minnesota Sioux Indian tribe. Those Indians that, what did I say? Whereabouts are they?
Worthington.
Huh?
Worthington.
No, where the hole in the ground is that they get that dough out that they make those.
I thought that's where
it was, Worthington. Oh, goodness sakes, life. Well, it's awful when your memory disappoints you like that. I know just well. I'll say it in a minute. Pipestone. Pipestone, Minnesota, the Minnesota Sioux Indian tribe has a mine there. They work it as a mine. They go down in the ground. It's about 30 foot deep now. And it's a clay. It's a vein of clay that does not harden until it comes out into the air. You bring it out in the air and then it hardens. They go down there and dig out that clay, bring it out, fashion articles out of it, various and sundry things, and then set it aside and let it harden. They make trays for on a desk, you know, the ash trays and things like that. And there's no white man has ever been in that. If they ever let a white man get into that mine, that clay's all going to harden down there, so they can't get it out. That's their honest belief. They do not permit any white man to enter that mine. And I'm going up there this summer, be the good Lord willing, and I can make it. I'm going up there. I think she'll be able to travel later on. We make a quick trip out of it, you know. And I'm going to go down in that mine. I'm a blood brother of the chief. I'm the only white man that's got a right to go in that mine.
Very good.
And I've been in it.
Really?
And I carried three ashtrays with me for years and years that I made while I was sitting on a little bench down in that mine. And brought them out, and they've got the thumbprint of the chief of the Minnesota Sioux on there alongside of my mine. And I'm his blood brother. They pricked our wrists and changed the blood. Oh, that was when we were racing. He had some race horses and that I used to race against in the when I was in the race business when I was a kid. And I was the only one who could beat him. He thought he held me on a pedestal that was way high. And he said I was the smartest, most reliable, and honest white man he'd ever encountered. He told that to a whole bunch of people one time that were in front of a great big tent. I can't name the town we were in, but it was a pretty good sized town in northern Iowa. They were holding a camp meeting of some kind there. And these few Indians I don't know why they, I don't know how they come to be there. As I can't think now, I didn't know. And they, when I walked up there, one of the Indians, he was in, had some regalia on, showing that he was an Indian. He had a few feathers on his shoulder, one thing or another. He walked over and put his hand on my shoulder, and he says to one of the other boys, he says, bring his badge or something. And they went and got a badge of some kind for me and put it on. He says, he's the only honest Indian that I encountered outside of our own tribe. That he believes what he says and says what he believes, and he tells nothing but the truth. And that's how I come to go to Pipestone to start with. And I sold him that one of my ponies. I sold the mare to a man in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Back in the days when the dollar was that big around, and I got $4,000 for that mare. And I sold the horse to the descendant for $2,000. And I know I could have taken him anywhere and got about triple that, or four times that much for him, but I wanted him to have him. And they didn't have much money, actual cash money. But he raised $2,000. I let him have it. And that I'm taking, it was taking place now when I wasn't over about 15 or 16 years old, maybe 17, 16. I wasn't over that.
Okay, came back to the medical
school. Get my leg fixed up. See, my leg was shot.
Okay.
And then I left there and came back to this part of the country, and I finally got so I could walk pretty good with a cane. I still walk with a cane part of the time. That's a really cane. Look at that. Oh, look at that cane.
Oh, carved.
That cane was made for me in Central America, and I've had it ever since.
Really nice. Okay, you say you came back to this part of the country?
I'm trying to think what part, where did I come to? At the outbreak of the Second World War, I think I went to Washington. Anyhow, they glommed onto me and put me in charge of they made me chief of the U.S. Customs Service on all the Mexican border, from Brownsville to, oh, I never can say the town of that, the name of that darn town. What's out on the Mexican border from here out on the other side of El Paso? The next one.
What? No. Tijuana?
No. On the other side of El Paso.
Juarez?
Huh?
Juarez?
No. Well, anyway, there's a town out there that, well, I was in charge of all the customs service on all this Mexican border.
Beg your pardon?
Laredo.
No, Laredo is just up the way. That's just a little bit. No, I was way out on the other side of. I wonder if there's any hope of a man ever recovering his memory.
No.
Well, now the name of that town, I've been there many, many times. Never for very long a time. And then I come on down this way, and of course there's all those little towns along in there. But I have a very poor memory.
All right.
Here for a while, it wasn't too good. It wasn't as good as it is now. It's improving a little bit here in the last 6 months. But, well, anyway, my office was in Roma. Rio Grande first. I opened an office in Rio Grande City, Texas, and had charge of all that custom stuff. We come across the river. And then I moved up. I didn't like to live in Rio Grande City, so I moved up to Roma. And I had what was officially known as the Roma Rio Grande Subdistrict. And that runs from there up to Laredo at the first. But later on, they opened it up clear on out to this other town. I can't think what the name of the town is. It was about three or four other entries, custom stations up there. And anyhow, I was on the Mexican border then as a customs officer, as a deputy collector of customs, in charge of such and such a sub-district, from there on up till I retired. And I retired did I retire?
Oh, yeah.
Before they would grow. But in 2 years' time, after I come back from there, give us a solid strip of bone that. And came back then to Indiana, and I stayed there a couple of years. Then the first World War broke out. My uncle told me they needed me in the Foreign Secret Service because I could speak, read, and write a couple other languages, especially Spanish. And when they found out I could talk Spanish, why, they had me set for Central America. So I went to Guatemala as chief of the Foreign Secret Service. And we had excellent success down there. We were to catch and put into, I can't think of the name of the jail they had. What do they call it? Well, anyway, from under confinement, all of the Germans who came down out of the United States through Mexico into Guatemala trying to get over to the coast of Central America there and get into their U-boats. They had some U-boats operating on the East Coast. And I and five of my men and two natives down there, two native men and two native women. That was my crew.
We succeeded in arresting 152 German spies that come down out of the United States trying to get to their U-boats and get back to Germany, going through Guatemala and Honduras, Guatemala and Nicaragua, Central America. But I had things lined up pretty well, and we did a very good job picking up those people. And the Secret Service Department in Washington gave me quite a send-off in a way, but nothing that can be traced down. They didn't want it to be traced down because they didn't want me traced from that episode that took place in Central America. Well, anyway, my leg kept on getting better and better, and I could use it. And finally, I went to Central America. The United Fruit Company in New Orleans. I ran across an officer of the United Fruit Company in New Orleans. Their headquarters was Boston, but they had an office in New Orleans where they handled all their fruit that they shipped up from down in Central America. They had huge plantations down there. And when he heard about me, he sent word that he would like to meet me, and I met him, and well, I went down to New Orleans and met him. They gave me a job down there. I was General Roustabout for the United Fruit Company. They bought me a $250 camera, and I made pictures all over Central America for them. I've still got some, too. And I took care of all their foreign obligations that employees that come down there. There was a lot of people come down there looking for work that they didn't hire, and they had to get them back out of the country because the government of Guatemala and Honduras and Nicaragua didn't want those floaters down there. And we had to make arrangements to get them out of there. And I had charge of that for a while. And for 2 years, I was the official photographer, just the photographer for the United Fruit Company. And then that didn't suit me too good, so I was on crutches. I still had never stepped on that leg. I was on crutches. I was out of the wheelchair, but I was on crutches. Then I finally got the crutches so I could handle them well enough, so I could handle a crew of men. So they wanted to know if I wanted to go down to Honduras and plant some new land work down there. So pretty soon I found myself at the head of 2,200 laborers, 27 foremen, can't think of the name of the town, and down there it was on the coast. Oh, if I had a map of Central America, I could pick it out like that, but I just can't do it now. We went to down there and planted bananas in more than half of that territory, and a lot of sugarcane, and constructed a distillery, and made alcohol, and we shipped shipload after shipload of alcohol, molasses, and everything you can imagine like that up here at the States to New Orleans. and for the United Fruit Company.
You say they were smuggling?
Oh, they smuggled everything imaginable from Mexico. From mules down to sweet potatoes. Girls, waitresses, everything. I arrested the sheriff of, what's the name of that dang county? Cameron? On the other side of Star County.
Cameron?
No, the next one on the other side of Star County.
Webb?
No, this side of Webb. That one right in between. Oh, shoot. Sheriff of Zapata County put him in jail for smuggling mules.
Mules?
Yeah. He smuggled over 40 mules. Well, he had been smuggling them. We knew that. I knew that. And I finally caught him where he had 20 mules on this side. And so one evening, about 4 o'clock, I took one of my men with me. We drove up from Rome up to Zapata and went over to the sheriff's office. And I told him, my man, I says, all right, you stay here now. And if you hear any trouble over there, well, then you come on and join in, but I don't think there'll be any. And I went over there and opened the door and walked in the sheriff's office. Walked back, he was sitting in a chair and he had 2 deputies around there. And I told him, I said, no, I don't want to sit down. I come on business. And I said, Mr. I can't say his name. Well, I called him by name. And I says, I've come to take you to Laredo or Brownsville, whichever you prefer. I said, as from this moment, you're under arrest for the smuggling of mules across the Rio Grande River from Mexico into the state of Texas. And he looked at me for about 2 minutes straight. He said, do you mean that? I says, yes, I do. And I had my hand on my pistol right here. I says, I mean it. I says, don't look down at that gun of yours. Just hand it to me. He reached over and pulled his gun out of the, handed it to me. And his 2 deputies stepped back. They didn't say a word. They just stepped back and he stepped up alongside of me and he and I walked out the door and down to my car and come back and I put him in jail.
About what year was this?
Huh?
About what year was this?
It was the last year that I was that I worked in the customs service. Well, I don't remember.
Okay, after the Second World War.
Yeah.
Well, what about during the Second World War? Were you the customs agent during the Second World War?
Let's see, the Second World War. Where was I? No, I wasn't a customs service. I was an officer. That's right, I was in the customs service. And I was down in this part of the country, but I didn't have the whole border at that time. I just had a little part of it down. I had what they call
I hope you never lose your memory like that. You don't lose it, you just can't find it sometimes.
Yeah.
I was living at Roma. Oh, I had the Roma Rio Grande sub-district.
Now, this one had sugar in it, so that will have to be yours.
He had the Roma Rio Grande subdivision?
Yeah.
During the Second World War. What activities, I mean, like, what was your main concern during the Second
Smuggling.
World War? Smuggling.
Smuggling? Yeah. Customs Service. U.S. Customs Service.
Right.
The U.S. Customs Service has charge of every article a person brings with them into the United States from a foreign country. Not at that time. We had,
When had you gathered them up?
When the war broke out.
Where'd you all?
I was back down in Guatemala.
Oh, this is the Second World War.
Yeah. Right at the start of it. We did that to gather up the spies that went back out of the United States and went down through Central America and into those sub-boats. And there was quite a lot of them. We caught quite a lot of them down there. They caught quite a lot of them on the river, too, up here. That is just after they crossed into Mexico.
What'd y'all do with those? What did y'all do with those?
In permanent jail. Permanent jails around the country. I don't know what was the final windup of them. I just don't know. I was in so many organizations there. Every time they'd need a new man for something, they'd come glom on to me, and I'd do the best I could on it and clean that mess up and I'd get straightened up, and here they'd come again for something else. And but I finally retired in 1965.
45 or 55.
It was either 45 or 65.
You have told me a time or two that it was
then I retired.
That's
more like it.
1947?
Yeah.
Okay. And then what would you...
Oh, I just went around and tried to gather up all my loose ends then and find the stuff that I'd lost and so forth had been stored around here and there. And 47, that's right, that's when I retired. But I was crippled up then, pretty bad. That leg went bad on me, you know. It kept getting worse again. And finally, it got so I had to stop walking on it for a while. But, there's a doctor down in Brownsville that helped me quite a bit with that, and then I finally got so I could step on it again, and it kept getting better. I can step on it now. I walk now. I put on my shoes, boots. I don't wear anything but boots.
Yeah.
I have 6 pairs of the best pair of boots that is ever made. There's some of them boots that are so old, it'd be surprising to you. There's one pair of boots there in particular. They look kind of old, I believe. No. That's one of them. That boot there is 14 years old.
Yes.
There's a pair of those boots. I still wear them. I still put them on and wear them once in a while. And they come on down about every 3 or 4 years. There's a new pair of boots here. Until you get over there, there's a new pair that I haven't ever. This pair right next to the door. That pair there. Let me see them. Yeah, this pair there hadn't been worn over 12 times. I've had them about 2 years. but they haven't been worn over about a dozen times, maybe not that much. I got a Mercedes when I was way on the West Coast. Come to Mercedes from to make my boots. And after they made three pairs for me, I didn't need to come anymore. All I did was write them a letter and tell them I wanted a pair of boots. I can go down there today and tell them I want a pair of boots. Copy of the old ones. In about a week's time, maybe 2 weeks' time, I can go down there and they'll hand me a pair of boots that looks just exactly like that pair there. Just exactly like them. They may change the initials, the shape of the initials a little bit. That's right, that sounds reasonable. In 47, when the time comes for me to, when I reach 65, why the government in Washington just sent me a notice and said that upon a signed declaration from me that as to my age, that if it was the same as their records, that I would be eligible to retire. And so I notified them what my record said, and so then I got a card back, a letter that since the date I was retired, I didn't amount to nothing no more. And so I've just been bumming around ever since. Things to which I'm entitled to say.
Oh, certainly.
I'm the oldest. Wait a minute now. Oh, we'll leave that go for a minute. I can't get it straight, maybe, without going looking up books. I can't think what I was going to tell you. It just left me just like that. Now in about an hour, maybe in 30 minutes from now, it'll be back.
Okay.
Let's see now. I've been in the part of the country.
You're the oldest ex-Marine?
Yeah.
Languages do you know?
Huh?
Which languages do you know now? You say you English
oh,
and...
Oh, Lord, now I gotta stop and think about them.
English, Spanish...
Mexicano. Mexican. Yo hablo español como un mexicano. At the end, eso le acaba. That's that I speak the language of the Brazilian. That's Brazilian language.
Portuguese?
No. let's see. Yo hablo español. Y hay que encender su día cava. Esteban, lo mismo. The only three that I remember well enough that I could talk.
Okay. You are fluent in Spanish completely, I mean.
Oh, yeah. I read and write Spanish, and I have ever since I was 11 years old. The reason why, there was this Mexican girl about 12, 14 years old,
that was brought up to Iowa by a family as a maid, you know, in the house. And that was near the town of Hawarden, Iowa. And in Hawarden, there was a family there. I don't remember just what the situation was in that family, but the wife of that family could speak Spanish. And she was the one that talked to this girl and was the only person that could talk to her, as far as we knew, in the state of Iowa. And so I took the girl over to Hawarden, and we visited with that family over there that could speak Spanish. And this girl taught me. We stayed over there 2 weeks. And she taught me to speak Spanish in 2 weeks. That is not perfect, but then pretty darn good. And we copied the language and put it down in such a way that I could translate it. You know, any time that I forgot any of the words, I could look it up. Then I bought an English-Spanish dictionary put out by somebody that had lots of sense. And they're not on the market anymore. I've tried to get one. I tried to get half a dozen different places. I tried to get one of those books. I've never succeeded in finding one. And I lost the one I had. Or somebody stole it. But anyhow, since that time up there, that girl finished up my Spanish in such a way that I really could talk Spanish. What I mean, I could talk Spanish and read it and write it. And I can sit down and write you a letter in Spanish just as good as I can in English and read it. You know. Oh, well, now wait a minute. Maybe I'm talking too fast on that. I haven't done that in 10 years. But really, no, really, I can read and write Spanish just almost perfectly. I know I can read it. I can pick up a Spanish newspaper and read it just as fast as I can one in English. I know that because I did that. There's a man out of Mexico, used to be a Mexican custom officer, that I got acquainted with back in the days when I was a gringo. Custom officer. You know what a gringo is. When I was a gringo custom officer, and we got pretty thick. He was the most honest Mexican I ever saw. The majority of them, you can't trust him too goddamn far. But he was just as honest as he could be. And I had several things come up that I had to trust him, and I found out that I could. Well, anyway. But I can't figure out where in the world those other two books went. But they wouldn't have been used to me here anyhow. Spanish is. Thank heavens I got a hold of the right book at the right time. Moved out here. Oh, I want to tell you something else. I was transferred out to this territory about 1934, one time. I don't know just why, but I was transferred out here by the government about 1934. some army officers that were trying to locate some plug or some what do you call them? They were markers, border markers. Some of them had been moved, you know. and they wanted me to come along to help them out if they got someplace where they had to talk Spanish, if we got over into Mexico. And transferred me down here in 1934. I remember that pretty well. I don't know why, but I do. And I first stopped in real close to Rio Grande City. It's a little town up just a little ways from beyond Rio Grande City. At that time, I don't know what it is now. And when they found out I could speak, read, and write Spanish around there, they certainly did straighten up. They were cheating those government officers. Oh, they'd be just robbing them. And when I walked over there and I said, now, how much did you say that you furnished? How many bushels so-and-so, or how much of this and that did you furnish? And I'd look at that paper and they'd say, oh, 10 bushels or 10 pounds or whatever it was, you know. And I said, well, in this book, it don't say that. It says that you furnished 7 kilos. And then they'd open their mouth, how you speak Spanish? Yo hablo español como yo hablo inglés. I tell them I speak Spanish just because I do English. Gosh dang, from then on we had no more trouble with them. Everything went off according to the way it should, you know. They found out that I could speak Spanish as good as they could, or maybe better. In some cases better, because you see, there's two kinds of Spanish. There's the Spanish that you speak daily, that and if you want to tell somebody something, legal papers or something like that, then there's another kind of Spanish. There's two kinds of Spanish. You all want to remember that. And I could get them either coming or going on that kind of stuff. When they found that out, they did straighten out. Now, I'll tell you. But I can't remember the name of that little town down there. There was quite a settlement there of shacks that had been built up to take care of these federal officers. You know, the I can't remember what they were. I don't know what branch of the service they were in. God, that's been a long time ago. I bet you it was the engineer's corps. I bet you it was that. Yeah. Well, anyway, in about a year's time, we got them straightened out. So that's how I come to be over in this part of the country when war broke out. No, I was here before the war broke out. Because they sent me, oh shoot, I'm mixed up now, I'm not telling things straight. When the war broke out, they sent me a company of soldiers to guard the bridge with up at Rio Grande City and Zapata and Cotula and those other towns up there. I had a company soldier at each one of those bridges. When the war broke out.
First World War?
Huh?
Second World War?
Second World War.
Did you ever have to use them?
Huh?
Did you ever have to use them?
No. There was no... The only time I would have had to use them would have been if they'd had some soldiers that were trying to cross over, you see. And they never did that. I had to line these up every morning and make them shoot at two targets out there and teach them how to shoot. God dang, they were a poor bunch of soldiers over to start with. Yeah, really, I had to teach them. I taught them how to shoot. Then when I got the first company to shooting pretty good, God dang, here it didn't come an old brigadier general or somebody like that along the line down there, and he said, "Well, Mr. Carr, you sure done a good job with those fellas." He said, "Would you transfer your quarters on down to so and so?" He says, "That bunch of soldiers down there," he says, "can't hit a..." I forget what he said, but it was awful. And he said, would you mind moving down there for a month or so and try to and show them a little bit about shooting? You know, I'm one of the crack shots of the country. I'm a distinguished pistol expert. Alice? Where's my cap with that insignia on it? One of the best rifle and pistol shots all around, with all kinds of guns and pistols that some of these experts ever saw.
I thought this was,
What?
What do you call it, DVA?
No. The DV?
Yeah.
No, that's the something. Well, that is the DAV hat.
Yeah. His little grandson was here.
Yeah, my grandson was down there, and he wanted that cap. Oh, he wanted it. But yeah. I couldn't let him have it. There's all those insignias on there, you know.
Well, if you hadn't caught us at it, he would have had it.
She'd have given it to him.
So
yeah, you can put that in there, that I'm a distinguished pistol expert, distinguished small bore expert, and distinguished hyper rifle expert.
Well,
it
would
be nice to have a reputation like that. How come I never knew how to do anything with water dishes and cook?
Well, I'm good enough that Remington Firearms Company paid me $325 a month and my other living expenses to travel around the country and go to their dealers and teach them how to handle a gun. Fleming Farms Company says I'm the best firearms handler they ever saw. What? Did you know I was on television for 4 years? I had a television show on KRGV and KGBT. I was on KGBT 6 months, and then I changed over to KRGV and went on the road with it. And I was 4 months in Harlingen, 4 months in Brownsville. I don't remember. Well, I was 8 months around this part of the country, you know, these different towns. And then I went on the road and went to Houston and Houston to other towns, you know, and kept on going north and around. And I spent 4 years on the road with my own television show. I did some stunts on that show that would make a guy's hair curl if he saw it. Yeah.
I think we're just about out of tape. Yeah. No.
1934.
Central Texas?
Well, yeah, it was right here. It was, what's the name of the town? Rio Grande City. Rio Grande City in 1934 as instructor to the officers of the U.S. Customs Service. I had to instruct them in the use of weights to weigh the different articles that came over and so forth. And well, that's getting into details out of your line. But anyhow, then they...
I thought maybe you would like to show this.
On the show one time. Yeah. That's the way the show looked from the backside.
Very nice.
Yeah, you name anything. I've been in it somehow. You just name it. I've been in it or with it or around it. Well, anyway, they wanted me to show or to instruct those guys how to shoot. Yeah. And I started then teaching them quick action with a gun, a pistol. How they could lay them. Small. We used to have to get matches, you know. You ever seen those penny box of matches? Lay penny box of matches on the back of your wrist like that. You know? Toss it up in the air, then hit it with a pistol before it hit the ground. And I was teaching that to the Texas Rangers over Rio Grande City. And after I taught 7 Rangers to do that pretty good, they scattered. You know, they were moved. In about 6 months, I got orders from the chief of the Texas Ranger Division in Austin not to instruct any more of their men in snap pistol shooting. Some of them were trying to teach others, and the others were shooting themselves in the ankles. Absolutely. I had to quit teaching them. They were shooting themselves up in their legs. Over on at Rio Grande City, there's a place just outside of town there that I built. Jack. That I could hang targets on the front of the shack, you know, and get off any distance to shoot at them, either with pistol up close or rifle off ways. I done some shooting over there that was just out of this world. I always was a good rifle and pistol shot. Always was. Shoot, I started shooting with a Belgium rifle that was imported into the United States from the country of Belgium. It was made in about 19... I think the marks on that were, it said 1901 or something. A 22 rifle. And I started shooting with that thing then. I've been shooting ever since. Oh, we've missed a great deal of my... How long can you stay?
Well, I'm letting you... say I got to go back this evening. Tell something about your gun shop. You did quite a bit of work in it, right?
Oh, I did a lot of work on mine. When I was stationed at Roma, when I lived in Roma, I lived there 8 years. And I had a gun shop in the corner, big corner room there, the big building. I had the largest building in Roma and the front room on the downstairs over the sidewalk. That room was 20 feet square, and it had been fixed up as a schoolroom when I moved there, but I quickly changed that over into a gun shop, and with the purchase of necessary tools, and some people gave me, and one thing or another, I started working on guns at nights and Sundays and holidays with the permission of the Secretary of the Treasury. See, I was a federal officer, and I had to have his permission to operate a gun shop. And so I had a gun shop there for 6 years, good one. I bought some expensive machinery and knew how to use it and knew how to turn out some pretty nice work. And I sold a few guns from there for very high prices. I sold guns as high as $600. Back in the days when you could buy a regular high priced hunting rifle for $100, they paid me $400, $500, and $600. There's a doctor in Little Rock, Arkansas that's got two of my rifles that he paid me $375 a piece for. Hard to catch. And of course I had to have a permit from the Secretary of the Treasury to operate an outfit like that while I was Chief of U.S. Customs Service there. And he said when I was up there in Washington, they told me, he said they'd been looking for a man like me for a long time. They wanted somebody that knew a gun, one end from the back end of a gun.
The Boy Scouts for memoirs.
Are you
on? How about the Boy Scouts for memoirs?
The what?
Boy Scout.
Boy Scout leader too. I was the rifle instruction leader at the Boy Scout camp for 9 years. Down
Camp Perry.
Camp Perry, down at Boy Scout Camp Perry down below Arlington. And we had as high as 400 boys over there in the summertime teaching them to shoot. And I run a rifle range there and told them how to shoot, how to handle a rifle correctly and safely. We had as high as 400 boys at a time for 9 years. I was down there. Of course, I was retired then, you see. Didn't have nothing else much to do.